I'm John Krall. It's been nearly 50 years since much of city and county government merged in Indianapolis as part of the process that came to be known as Unigov. We'll talk today on No Limits about how Unigov happened and how it has changed Indiana's largest city. My guests are Director of the Institute of Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives at the University of Indianapolis, Ted Frantz, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor and business leader John Mutz, and IUPUI Professor of Political Science, Bill Bloomquist. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. It's been nearly 50 years since much of the city of Indianapolis and Marion County governments merged here as part of a process that came to be known as Unigov. We're going to talk today about the significance of that moment, about the challenges that process faced a half century ago, and also about the ways it has transformed life here in central Indiana and, frankly, throughout the state. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests today are the director of the Institute of Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives at the University of Indianapolis, Ted Frantz, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor and business leader John Mutz, and IUPUI Professor of Political Science, Bill Bloomquist. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. So, Ted, I'm going to start with you. We probably ought to set a baseline because it has occurred to me that for anyone, you know, who was aware of when this was going on has to be in minimum of her or his late 50s right now to have been cognizant of it. So we had to, and for most people.
Or more.
Yeah. For most people, you know, Unigov doesn't seem like a revolutionary idea. It is just a given fact. It's like the landscape. It's always been here. So let's talk a bit about what Unigov is and was.
Sure. And again, I'm not originally from Indianapolis, and I think many people my age just take it for granted, as you said, John. Mm-hmm. But it fundamentally redefined what the city was and what the city could be. John could speak at length about sort of what their goals were and what they were hoping to do to a city. But I think the context that's incredibly important is that American urban areas in the late 1960s were going through a time of crisis. That was true throughout the Midwest. Here in Indianapolis, it was more stagnant, and they wanted to revitalize the city. At the same time, there were a lot of inefficiencies, and so you had an opportunity that really Democrats had first recognized in the 1965 session, that really you had a weak mayor, lots of different authority distributed across the county, political appointments from both parties. And so there was an effort in 1965 to bring more mayors to power to the mayor's office. And then most of what they tried to accomplish in the legislature, however, did not pass. Among other things, opposition from the main news sources here, the Star and the News, calling it a power grab. Fast forward a couple of years later, when the Republicans under Keith Bulin had revitalized their machine here in Indianapolis, of which John Mutz to my left was a part, then there was an opportunity once Dick Lugar was elected mayor in 1967 to start implementing some ambitious ideas. And that's just teasing the beginning of that story, and I'll let other people come in here.
So, Lieutenant Governor Mutz, if you could you talk about what the motivation was? Take us back to that time, what the motivation was for moving toward Unigov.
I would start by saying that one of the messages that this event, I guess, portrays is the important aspect that political movements play. Preceding the enactment of the UNIGOV bill, Keith Bulin and a group of renegade, we'll call them today, Republicans, took control of the Republican Party in Marion County. And I was one of those. And we did this at a time when we suddenly found ourselves with a Republican city council, Republican county council, a Republican governor, a Republican House in the legislature, and a Republican Senate in the legislature. Seldom ever are all of the levers of power lined up they were at that moment. So what we were looking at was a brand new Rhodes Scholar mayor, very young, very ambitious, but also very bright, who we worked with in the early sessions that we all participated in. The image of Indianapolis, as determined by the Chamber of Commerce and almost everybody else, was no image. It was India, no place. Cornfield with lights.
Well, and there was that old joke about how the flight attendants would say, you've just landed in Indianapolis, set your watch back an hour or 25 years, whichever you prefer.
Well, that's one of the jokes. Kurt Vonnegut is allegedly said that Indianapolis was a place where everybody watched a race one day a year and then slept the other 364. Later on, he denied saying that, but nevertheless, it was a sleepy place.
Yeah.
So what happened was, as a result of this election and the change that came about, a lot of young idealists suddenly said, we can do better. We want to remake Indianapolis. We were essentially dreaming about a city that had all the things in it that we thought we should have. And the first thing we wanted was a first-class research, state-supported university in Indianapolis. And for a long time, Indiana University and Purdue University had had extensions here, not a lot of activity, comparatively speaking, to the mother campuses. So we saw this as our first objective. And this, what happened was the conversation when we planned our bill that we created what we called then the University of Indianapolis. During that conversation, it was a group of 10 young men having dinner at John Burkhart's house on the west side of Indianapolis. And Dick Lugar was among the 10. And so what happened was essentially somehow or another, Dick complained about the fact that he didn't have the power to do anything about the development of our new reservoir, the Eagle Creek Reservoir. And out of that conversation, and to this day, I don't know who first said it, but the idea was may have been Carl Dorch, who was the new leader of the Chamber of Commerce. But anyway, somebody said, why don't we unify the government in Marion County? Well, if you knew how Dick Lugar's mind works, he had read extensively about metropolitan government in other parts of the country. And it was as if you turned his tape recorder on because he began to spew facts out about what had taken place in other places. He mentioned everything from New York City to Jacksonville, Florida, and so forth. And it's out of those conversations that the UNIGOV idea was begun. Now, to be very candid and frank, under Jim Beatty, the Democratic county chairman at the same time, they had proposed to do their version of UNIGOV. And it would have transferred a number of appointive authorities and so forth under their mayor. They thought he would be their mayor at that point. And the Star and News killed it. So that's where it started.
So, Bill, you know, that sounds actually now, because it's sort of an accepted fact of our history and all of that, doesn't give justice really to how controversial the idea was when it came up and how pitched the battles were. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll do my best. The conversations that Ted and John have already alluded to taking place here in Indianapolis were also taking place in the context of other city-county combinations that were being tried out. So John Mutz just mentioned Jacksonville, for example. So there was Jacksonville and Duval County. There was Nashville and Davidson County, Tennessee. There was Miami-Dade County. So the UNIGOV, as important as it is to Indianapolis, it isn't entirely unique. This was one of the reform ideas that was in play at the time, and that people who were interested in reform for our local governments here latched onto and started to think about our own version of that. But to set a little bit of the context, and then we can get into it more if you want. John rightly pointed out that by 1967, 68, and 69, by the time of the UNIGOV bill, the stars had aligned politically with Republican control of city, county, and state government. But prior to that, in the 20 years leading up to UNIGOV, Democrats had won three of the five municipal elections in that 20-year period. And as already has been mentioned, there was a Democratic mayor, Democratic majority on the city council after the 1965 elections, or sorry, 1963 elections, and then the county was Republican. And it was clear to people who paid attention to local politics that if you combine city and county government under those circumstances where the city was tending Democratic and the county was Republican, that somebody was going to lose. And so that sets the stage for it to be controversial, because it wasn't only about control in terms of strengthening the mayor's office or changing the organization of city and county government. There was a partisan overlay to it, too, in terms of who was going to be the victor and who was going to be the vanquished if you made this change.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the upcoming 50th anniversary of UNIGOV here on No Limits Today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Bill, you talked a bit about the partisan dynamic. There also were all sorts. I mean, that even that oversimplified. I mean, there were racial dynamics. There were all sorts of things. When we did a documentary last year on Richard Lugar's life and legacy, that's aired again recently with the senator's passing. He talked about those difficulties as being almost insurmountable and says, well, actually, I see Lieutenant Governor Mutz wants to take the question.
Well,
for you.
What I was going to say is that this was not an ordinary year in the nation either.
No.
1968 was the year in which Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for another term as president. I think probably because of his involvement in the Vietnam War. And at the same time, the Black Power movement was in ascendancy. Birth control had become popular and accepted. This was the moment in the 60s when some people claim that in Indianapolis we slept through the 60s. I don't buy that, but we were certainly not aggressively involved like many of the other communities. We did not have as many racial tensions as other cities had. I won't say they weren't there, but they were maintained and controlled by an unbelievable, I think, liaison between black pastors and white pastors in Indiana. Okay. I like to think that Dick Lugar had something to do with this, too, because they saw in him somebody who would listen.
Well, but go ahead.
I think it's also important, and John, I've often heard John Mutz point this out, is that, you know, the Republican Party, especially in Marion County in 1968 and 1969, was not the Republican Party of today. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, the Party of Lincoln still had resonance with a good portion of the population in Indianapolis. And some estimates, when Dick Lugar ran for re-election of mayor in 1971, he got about 33% of the African American vote. So that's something else to keep in mind here, is that although today most African Americans vote for the Democratic Party, especially in the context of the late 1960s, especially in the context of state politics, the Republican Party was actually the party that was probably a little bit more progressive, if you will, especially when it came to racial matters. So when you were asking your question about mm-hmm. how forces aligned, you couldn't just do a simple diagram in the way you might be able to today.
And that's something we'll dive into when we come back. We are talking about the upcoming 50th anniversary of UniGov, you know, a political moment that has reshaped the Indianapolis of its time and continues to reshape the city and county today. My guests are Director of the Institute of Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives at the University of Indianapolis, Ted Franz, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor and business leader John Mutz, and IUPUI Professor of Political Science Bill Bloomquist. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881, send us an email, or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 50th anniversary, upcoming 50th anniversary of UniGov today on No Limits. My guests are Ted Franz. He is the director of the Institute of Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives at the University of Indianapolis. John Mutz, who's a former Indiana Lieutenant Governor and business and now a business leader. And Bill Bloomquist, who is an IUPUI Professor of Political Science. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So we actually had to rush to your point, Ted, to get to the break. You were talking about how complicated not just the partisan politics of that era were, but the racial politics as well, and that the clear lines of demarcation that we often see today weren't in place then.
Yeah, and I think also if you go back and look at the sources, which as historians we like to do, you see that the fault lines were even complicated by something like open housing, where if you're going to extend the city through all of Marion County, there would be some forces who would oppose that because they didn't want to see African-American housing in areas that had been the suburbs. So you get some African-Americans speaking in favor of it because they thought it would actually help advance housing issues throughout the larger area. So it's not as predictable, I think, as people today might think about how those various forces played out.
Some of that is probably also the, you know, when something is in the past, it assumes this aura of inevitability, and it really wasn't inevitable. Was it, Lieutenant Governor?
No, I'll verify that it was a tough slog all the way through, no question. And I guess, you know, your goal was always 51 votes in the House and 26 votes in the Senate, and we barely got those in the Senate. We did get more than we needed in the House.
What made it so tough?
Well, let's start by saying that the Republican Party, although we had taken control, was not totally unified. There were other parts of the party.
So it was just like any other human institution.
Yeah, well, the other parts of the party who didn't like the fact that they had lost this primary election. And some of the existing office holders were in that category. There also was concern among a number of power centers in the county. Now, by that I mean the townships. Now, most people today would say that's not a power center. Well, it isn't exactly a power center, but the township trustees, the township fire departments, all of that activity generated political leverage. They were the people who ran for precinct committeemen. They were the people who participated in party activities. They were scared to death that we were going to grab them up too in this process. And then, of course, the most pressing matter was schools. See, our original bill sought to unify the school district in Indianapolis. And as I look back on it now, I sure wish we could have done that. It would have made a difference, I think, in a variety of circumstances. But it was not in the cards. Mm-hmm. The township schools were, once again, concerned about the movements of ethnic and racial groups. Mm-hmm. And the term people used for it then, maybe still do, is white flight. Mm-hmm. And hundreds of, quote, white families were leaving the IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools, and moving to the townships. And, of course, they did this allegedly because they thought there was a higher quality of education there. But the racial issue was very much in the back of their minds. And so the other thing that was going on, of course, at this time was the development of the Black Power movement. And we had some aspects of that in Indianapolis. And those are folks who said, listen to us. Why aren't you paying attention? That's what that was about.
Well, you know, like even someone like Bill Crawford, you know, who was, you know, at the beginning of his career was Black Panther. Mm-hmm. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the upcoming 50th anniversary of UniGov. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, you're on the air.
Yes. From the time I called to now, Lieutenant Governor Mutz had already covered it, but it was such a glaring omission to leave the school, and it's left the IPS crippled ever since. So I just wanted to make sure that was brought out as one of the less beneficial aspects of UniGov.
Thanks very much for calling and sharing that point. And we are going to talk about that some more because it is one of the more lasting legacies. Thank you very much, Margaret. So, you know, in some ways, and this is probably an imperfect parallel here, but I've long thought that the omission, you know, the decision basically to leave the school districts out was somewhat similar to, you know, the compromise in the U.S. Constitution regarding slavery. You know, it was what would have been perhaps an insuperable problem at the time, and to get the deal done, as it were, it had to be kicked down the road a little while, but there were tremendous difficulties that followed in both cases. I'll let Bill speak to it first, but I'm going to give everybody a chance to weigh in on that one.
Yeah, I mean, the critical factor was to get enough votes among legislators to pass the UniGov bill. And in the course of doing that, a number of compromises got made. And we've already talked about the fact that the school districts were left out. But John Mutz's point about the townships, critical as well. And then there were four municipalities that were the so-called excluded cities that weren't included in UniGov. I mean, there's the final product, the UniGov bill that passed the General Assembly in the 1969 session, is not the bill that was initially drafted. It's not the vision that was originally put together. It was what was left, if you will, in some ways, after certain elements had to be peeled off out of a recognition that you'd have opposition if you tried to bring the townships in and if you tried to bring the school corporations together, and that certain municipalities had enough weight with legislators to get carved out. So there was, you know, there was just the legislative politics of that that was part of what the final bill became, which was less than was what was originally intended.
What was, you know, Lieutenant Governor Mutz, since you were there and you were part of this process,
yes,
what was the original scope of the plan for UniGov? What things other than the schools got left by the side of the road?
Well, of course, we started with the assumption that everybody was covered in this situation. I don't know whether Dick Lugar talked about this during his interview with you last year, but I was with him on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we first introduced the bill under the auspices of a group called the Citizens, what's the right term? Can't think of it now. Anyway, the group organized under the mayor. It was bipartisan, had people from varieties of walks of life and so forth.
Progress Committee.
The Indianapolis Progress Committee. That's it. At any rate, so what happened was we took the bill out, And Dick would make an appearance at a locality in Marion County someplace. It could be a high school gym or something like that. And the lawyers and some of us who were sponsors and legislators went with him. And as complaints were waged, we took notes. And the bill was like a work in progress. We changed the bill all the way through that hearing process, listening to the people who were complaining. Now, we couldn't accommodate everybody, of course, but the result was that compromises were made. That's kind of the way things get done in the Indiana General Assembly or any body of that type. They often, you know, kid about the fact it's like making sausage. Well, the fact of the matter is that you had to have a bill that you thought you could pass.
Mm-hmm.
And we got one that we thought we could pass, but just barely.
If I could, Margaret's question, I mean, has the benefit of hindsight. I think what was interesting at the time, and I think she's right in what she said, but even at the time, if you go back and look at a few of the notes from the Progress Committee, you get Carl Dorch and Tom Hasbrook, who were colleagues of John Mutz's, saying, boy, we wish we could do this, but politically, we don't have the courage or we don't have the capital to do both schools and consolidation of the city at the same time. They recognized, because schools have always been, but particularly then, were so emotionally charged nationally, that this was that would be an issue of of immense proportion in and of itself.
Yeah, because that, at this point, you're 15 years into, more than 15 years into the pitched battles over desegregating schools and all of that. So they were a flashpoint. But, you know, to get to Margaret's point about IPS, at that time, if I'm not mistaken, it was a school system that served more than 100,000 students. And now it's, 35. So it's about a third the size of what it was. We've gotten an email from a listener named Mona. And again, if you want to join this conversation by email, you can send your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Mona writes, never got finished. Fire departments are combining for cost-cutting measures. Schools are still separate. Nine superintendents make huge salaries when one unified system would be more efficient and less expensive. Some of this, the schools are the big one, but yeah, fire departments and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, there were these tiny, well, what Lieutenant Governor referred to as power centers or whatever, that fought to hold on to their independent lives. Correct, Bill?
Yep.
Or Jim?
Absolutely. One of the, as important as Unigov is in the history of Indianapolis, there's also some mythology around it, and many public services did not get changed in terms of who delivered what to whom. As a consequence of Unigov, it wasn't just the schools that didn't get consolidated, as the emailer and as the caller have indicated. It was police, it was fire. I mean, the political leadership, city council, county council combined into the city county council, the mayor becoming the chief elected officer of the county, you know, that consolidation occurred. But if you look at the period before Unigov, there were a number of services that had already gone countywide. There was the Health and Hospital Corporation. There was the Airport Authority. There were, you know, a variety of things. And at least as far as I've been able to discover, in the aftermath of the passage of the bill, there wasn't any public service that was delivered on a countywide basis after Unigov that wasn't already delivered on a countywide basis before Unigov. And that what happened is, as the emailer has said, then a piece-by-piece expansion of jurisdictions happened over the 50 years since the passage of the legislation, so that now we have IMPD, but that wasn't a Unigov thing. Now we have a fire department that also serves several of the townships in the county, but that wasn't a Unigov thing. So a number of these things have come after, not directly as a result.
Ted, go ahead, Lieutenant Governor.
No, go ahead.
Ted, okay. So in terms of this, what's the motivation? We've talked about a lot of the roadblocks, but less about what UniGov was supposed to accomplish. Was the drive behind it primarily to create economies of scale here, or what else was it? What problem was it trying to solve?
Let me do a quick, what I hope is a quick answer, and then sure. pitch it to John. which is that, again, context for when they first were having these conversations, I think, is extremely important about what they wanted. And what they were talking about were what are qualities that go into making a great city. So if you start with that premise, and the first idea, again, as Lieutenant Governor Mutt said, was a great university, and second, that you had an attractive area that people wanted to be a part of, that probably more than anything else was the motivating factor from what I understand. So therefore, you know, I think a lot of what was possible in Indianapolis came as a result of what UniGov accomplished. But again, that bigger goal, I don't think was so much about government or governing, but rather about making an attractive
city.
Well,
then let me reframe the question, because why did we think that UniGov was a way to get to that goal then? Why did we think that was the means?
I think we thought it was the way to get to the goal, and I think it has proved to be true, mm-hmm. that the central nature of leadership and focus on individual goals, not mm-hmm. disparate goals within the county. One thing Bill didn't mention was that while some of these services had already become countywide in nature, they were independent tax organizations. They could enact their own tax rate, do what they wanted to do without accountability to anybody. What UniGov did was put all those agencies under the budget control of the legislative body, the City County Council. And that accountability feature then transferred indirectly to the chief executive, mm-hmm. because he then could begin to make his concerns noted and ask the people who were appointed to those agencies to pay attention.
Right. That's a critically important point. And in addition, there was some reorganization of the executive branch of city government as well. So the mayor had a smaller number of larger departments rather than a larger number of smaller departments, and more of a cabinet structure. So there are some structural aspects of the UniGov reform that had effects beyond just service delivery and who provided which public services to which locations within the county.
So, Ted, take me back then to the early 1970s when all of this is taking effect. What were the biggest changes people who were living then saw in the, you know, how were their lives changed by UniGov's adoption?
Well, I think I would say that began to slow the process of white flight in some way and begin to attract talent and capital back to the business district. And so how would people begin to see that change? They might see people on the streets after 5 p.m. They might have a reason to come downtown. And I mean, think soon thereafter with Market Square Arena being built. I mean, I don't think you would have even had Market Square Arena built as close to the city county building if you wouldn't have had UniGov. It gave a reason and provided an anchor in some ways to attract talent back into the center business district at a time, again, regionally across the Midwest, when that was not taking place. Think about St. Louis, think about Cleveland, some other neighboring cities where, you know, that power was just going farther and farther out.
Or Cleveland and Detroit, I think, are the two classic examples of, sure. of powerhouses that are now near abandoned. Dick Lugar said that it hadn't happened in any other northern city since then. Is that the case, Ted?
Well, in St. Louis, they've recently been trying,
yeah.
and as of this week, announced they might have to postpone yet again, John. So it's one of these things. It proves to be very difficult to get the kind of cooperation that John Mutz was able to achieve. Get everybody lined up.
Yeah, I met with the St. Louis group. And
actually, we'll have to pick the point up on the other side. We've got a break coming up. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of UniGov. My guests are Ted Franz from the University of Indianapolis, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, and IUPUI Professor of Political Science Bill Bloomquist. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the 50th anniversary of UniGov. My guests are from the University of Indianapolis, Ted Franz, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor and business leader John Mutz, and from IUPUI, Bill Bloomquist. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Lieutenant Governor Mutz, we're running into the break, and you had a point you wanted to make.
The point I wanted to make is that the folks from St. Louis who wanted to do a unified approach to their region came here to Indianapolis, and a number of us made presentations to them and conversations. We got around to one, I think, very important question, and that was the fact that we were criticized by some because we did not use a referendum, that is a countywide vote, to make this decision. We used the legislature because, in fact, in Indiana, local government is, they say, a creature of the legislature. So at the legislative level, we had the power to do this. And after testing the situation, we concluded we could not have passed a referendum at that point. And so the choice was, do you go forward or do you abandon the project? Dick Lugar and all the rest of us were unified. Now, parts of our delegation were not unified. There were certain members who withheld their votes on that issue and others. As a matter of fact, I'd have to tell you that one of the leading opponents of this activity was my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was county recorder at the time this was going on.
That must have made for some interesting holiday conversations.
Yeah, well, it almost eliminated a couple of holidays. But at any rate, she was part of the group of office holders who wanted the Republican Party changed when the Action Committee made its move. But when we came up with this idea, she maintained it was a communist conspiracy.
Oh, boy. Go ahead, Bill.
Communist conspiracy notwithstanding, there was controversy for exactly the reason that John Mutz's comment about the referendum indicates. This was a divisive, wasn't necessarily intended to be a divisive, but it became in fact a divisive issue here locally, just as it has been in other places that have discussed and attempted city-county consolidations. As you said, if it had been put to a referendum, it probably would not have passed. And it's important, again, sort of the mythology of UniGov. We've had it for 50 years. Indianapolis has been a very successful Midwestern city. So there's a tendency to think that at the time that this idea was introduced, everybody must have just woke up one morning and said, "Oh my gosh, this is brilliant! Let's do this." And it was hardly the case. There was some significant opposition for a variety of reasons.
We got an email, and again, if you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Normally, we only use first names on the program, but given the nature of the email, this is from Jonah Butler, who says that he's the interning planner for the city of Southport. I'm wondering if you could all strike up a conversation about how excluded cities, specifically Southport, which has less than 1 square mile in area and under 2,000 people, became defined as such. Lieutenant Governor Mutz.
Well, I don't have the data handy, but we had a population cutoff that determined whether your municipality was included. Originally, it was Lawrence Speedway and Beech Grove. Southport came along right during this time period, and they exceeded whatever the population was that qualified.
Mm-hmm. Just barely, right? Yeah. Maybe 5,000 at the time?
Yeah, I think 5,000.
It was close.
Is that right?
It was close, yeah.
Okay.
A few folks moved in with their in-laws for a couple of days. Got it over the
line. So it was sort of like the old school counting day, too.
Yeah.
So the other parts of Indiana politics and political history. Ted, I probably ought to talk about the fact that we're kind of racing through this complex period of history. If people have more curiosity about this time, got an opportunity coming up at your shop here in just about a week, right?
Yeah, thanks, John. And Lieutenant Governor Mutz will be there as well. Next week, as our 6th annual Richard M. Fairbanks Symposium on Civic Leadership, we're looking at UniGov at 50, Blueprint of the Urban Midwest, questioning that. talking about the lasting impacts, particularly about economics and race, and about what other cities have learned from the UniGov experiment. And that, again, is at the University of Indianapolis next Wednesday, the 15th. We have sold out, but there still is room on the wait list. We're really excited. We always partner with Indiana Humanities on that event. And it's been a wonderful gathering of people in the previous five iterations. We're, again, made possible through the support of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation. And people wanting to learn more about that can just go to news.uindy.edu for more about those sessions that we have on the 15th. We'll be able to get into a little bit more depth because, as you've said, we've barely scratched the surface in our conversation.
Well, and we've still got a little bit of time, and we've talked about the difficulties of it and where the city was. Probably ought to talk in the, now that we have a half century separating us, how UniGov changed the city, what marks it left on life here. Perhaps the best way, I guess, I'll start with you, Ted, is to talk about, what would Indianapolis look like if UniGov hadn't passed?
Wow. I mean, most of the things...
I know that's an exercise in alternative history, but yeah. It's still...
Most of the attributes that I think people love about downtown Indianapolis, it's hard to imagine those really being there, or at least in the ways that they developed without UniGov. I alluded to Market Square Arena, which is no longer part of the skyline. But if the sports strategy, for instance, really began to take off in the 1970s, Market Square Arena was one of the first steps there. So building a downtown that was attractive to conventions had started a little bit, but that UniGov really helped to kickstart that. So I think most of what Indianapolis has built its brand and its reputation on, in large part, was due to UniGov, but it also, I think, built a reputation as a place where you had great, visionary, and strong mayors. And again, if you didn't have UniGov, I'm not sure that reputation would have been there. I'm not sure a Bill Hudnut or a Steve Goldsmith would have been as attracted to the mayor's office if it weren't for UniGov.
Bill, I'm going to give you the next word so we save last word for sure. Lieutenant Governor Motz here.
I think the principal legacy of UniGov is the consolidation of political leadership that allowed an entire generation of civic-minded public servants to see projects through to completion that were multi-year projects that would have been hard to accomplish without the stability of a same person being president of the City County Council for 30 years, of a mayor who could serve 16 consecutive years like Bill Hudnut did, of people in the departments of city government, city county government, staying in office through long enough periods of time to see really large-scale ideas come to fruition.
Lieutenant Governor Motz.
Bill is right in his observation from my viewpoint, but I would also say that this kind of leadership that we saw in the political realm mm-hmm. transferred from the business community and became active, deeply involved. And I guess what I'm always amazed about is the fact that following UniGov several years after was the development of a thing called the City Committee. Now, most people never heard of it. It wasn't formal, but it was a group of about 30 young men and women who were committed to dreaming and building a city that they wanted to live in. And the results of that are hard to describe. The National Sports Festival came in Indianapolis. The NCAA headquarters came to Indianapolis. Following on the heels of that are all kinds of sporting events. But also, in the other realms, we have a viable symphony today in Indianapolis. We had one before, but it barely survived recently. And I think without the kind of leadership that's been present, things like that would not have occurred.
Bill.
Indianapolis has been fortunate. Some of the things that we now chalk up to UniGov in retrospect were also done through the leadership of state government. If you look at some of the places that we're talking about that make downtown Indianapolis so attractive, the White River State Park with the State Museum and the Eideljorg and the lawn and, you know, everything that is there, that was done really in the 80s, probably Orr Mutt's administration, if I recall correctly. So a lot of excellent things have happened about downtown Indianapolis over the 50 years since UNIGOV. Not all of them can be chased back to UNIGOV.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Elizabeth. Again, our email address is nolimitswfyi.org. Elizabeth writes, please address the systemic racism of UNIGOV. In addition to the school issue, it was an effort of the Republican Party to keep control of the city government. I'm going to throw that one to you, Ted, because actually that was a point you addressed. We've alluded to this earlier in the conversation, but you addressed pretty directly in the documentary about Dick Lugar.
Yeah, I think that is a charge that is much easier to make in 2019 when you don't realize that the Republican Party in Marion County at the time had a very visible and strong component of African Americans. So I think if the emailer were directing that to say it was more aimed at Democrats, mm-hmm. I think that would be accurate. But I don't think it's fair to say it was primarily racial in its design. I see why there are parts of the community who feel like they may have not benefited from some of those.
And to be fair, Bill Crawford was saying at different points that he saw it, and certain members of African-American leaders saw it as a way to keep an African-American from becoming mayor.
Right. But, yeah. I mean, that would be the fairest comparison to make, would to say at the time that Dick Lugar got elected mayor of Indianapolis, Richard Hatcher got elected mayor of Gary. The trend in the urban Midwest was towards the consolidation of African-American urban power in a mayor's seat.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to point out that the Recorder, the voice of the African-American community, it's the African-American newspaper, which still exists.
Oldest
of its kind in the country.
Yeah.
They endorsed the UNIGOV legislation. And it, as I look back on it, it's a miracle that they did. But they saw in it single-member districts that they knew would be filled by African-Americans so that the voice would be present, and they would always be at the table. They had previously not been at the table in Indianapolis.
Well, that's one of the things that Lugar said in the interview, was at least one of his primary motivations was this was a way for us to get everyone to the table so that we all could be talking about the same problems and working the same things. Bill, you're
at the same time, it did relegate the Democratic Party in Marion County to minority status for 30 years. And at a time when African-American voters were becoming, this is not to disagree with the point Ted was making about the Republican Party, but African-American voters were becoming the largest segment of the voting base of one of the two competitive political parties in Marion County. And after the consolidation of city mm-hmm. and county government, Democratic influence went to pretty close to zero. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, African Americans, who were becoming a larger and larger share of one of the two competitive parties, were now a large share of a political party that had virtually no local government power at all. And it's not surprising, therefore, that 50 years later, people look back on UNIGOV and see that racial impact. It was an impact that was driven primarily through the impact on the Democratic Party, but the impact on African-American voters as an important part of the voting base of the Democratic Party is it's hard to deny.
It's well said, Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, we are getting toward the end of the program. We have just a few minutes left. I want to ask something that has puzzled me, because while there obviously were costs and real problems associated with this, as we've also talked about, there were some significant benefits to the adoption of UNIGOV, and it had a transformative effect on at least definitely downtown Indianapolis and other parts. Why didn't it happen anyplace else, you know, in the North? Yeah, go ahead.
The only other place in the North, and this is really a kind of a reach, but the only other unified government program that was done this way, legislatively rather than with a referendum, was New York City. The five boroughs of New York were unified in their system in a similar kind of governmental move. I think most people would say that was a beneficial change there.
But why wouldn't other cities, Midwestern cities that weren't like Cleveland and Detroit, we've referred to? Why, Ted, go ahead.
I'll try to go through it quickly. One thing about Indianapolis that's different is again that as John Mutt said earlier, that cities are a creature of the state, and in most neighboring states, there was more independence for the cities where they didn't have to go to a legislature. So they might have already had greater power in the mayor's office dating back to the Progressive Era. If you look to places like Detroit, Cleveland, and Toledo had really made a reputation in the 19-teens for being leaders in urban reform. So Indianapolis lacking that actually ended up being a benefit to the Lugar administration as a process available to them to go to the legislature when, as John Mutt said, all the stars were aligned.
Bill.
I agree with all of that and would point out that in Indianapolis, the inner city, the center city, the city of Indianapolis, was not surrounded by large incorporated municipalities, whereas in Cleveland, Detroit, and some of the other metropolitan areas, you couldn't just come along and knock over a 20, 30, 50,000 person municipality next door and say, you're now going to be part of city-county government. So, and the analogy here is Columbus, Ohio, which has also been a high-growth, high-success city in the last 50 years. And the city limits in Columbus, Ohio were moved out to the Franklin County boundaries without consolidating city and county government. But with a significant increase, therefore, in the voting base and the population base of the city of Columbus. But Columbus could do that again because Columbus wasn't locked in by a large number of substantially sized incorporated cities.
Going to give the lieutenant governor
the last comment I'm going to make is that what happened here got the attention of organized philanthropy. By that I mean Lilly Endowment. The Lilly Endowment, prior to this time period, had spent most of its time outside Indianapolis in the international world. And Mr. Lilly, the last of the three Lillies who started it, said, we're coming home. We made our money here. We're going to support this local community. And among the major assets, we've talked about UniGov, we've talked about unification, we've talked about IUPUI, but not much today, but we will later maybe. The other thing was Lilly Endowment came along and committed virtually more than half of all of its grant making to Marion County. Now, that was a big deal.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Ted Franz, former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, and Bill Blomquist for what's been a lively conversation about an important period in Indianapolis's history. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.